based on anything we can do, and we want this grace that you have given to us to be to great effect in our lives for your glory. And so I pray on behalf of those who are listening, whether they're pastors who are leading churches that you've entrusted to them, or simply followers of Christ who are pursuing after you, I pray that you would give them grace to work through the implications of your gospel in every facet of their lives, and that your gospel would radically transform all of our perspective, the way we think and our living, the way we act, from our beliefs to our behavior, that everything would be transformed by the gospel, and that you would use us. You would use us for the spread of your glory and the advancement of this gospel to the ends of the earth. And we pray that you would help us not to waste our lives on anything less than radical abandonment to the global purpose for which you created us. We praise you for your grace and your mercy toward us. And I thank you for the opportunity. I hope, I pray, Lord God, that this day has been encouraging to those who are listening. In Jesus' name I pray.
Amen. Amen. Radical, taking back your faith from the American dream. Get a copy on the website, saveus.org. Become a partner. Send your gifts by faith, friends, to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. God bless you. Be a blessing. Let's give glory to God.
To Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Frederick Sheehan, who's written a fascinating book called Panderer to Power: The Untold Story of How Alan Greenspan Enriched Wall Street and Left a Legacy of Recession. And, of course, recently, Paul Krugman has written an article saying we're moving into a depressionary deflation, and it's going to go on for many years, and I think he's probably right. Whether we'll have inflation before that, only time will tell. But we're moving into terrible economic times, and the financial ship was guided to this point of destruction by a man named Alan Greenspan, and this is a biography. Now, Frederick, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me again, Dr. Stan.
Well, now, this is an entirely different audience, so don't hesitate at all to be repetitive of what you said on our afternoon program, but certainly you've done a biography here. But why is Alan Greenspan so important? Why, I mean, ordinarily we think about the President of the United States, certainly whether it be George Bush or Bill Clinton, and they're responsible for the economy, and they get credit when things go well, and they get criticized when things don't go well. But what's the truth of the matter? Do the president really set the economic policy, or is it the chairman of the Fed?
Well, it has turned into the job of the Federal Reserve. You know, historically, through most of human history, there were no central banks, and we did pretty well. And it's only been really within the last 20 or 30 years that central banks have gotten such a prominent role in the public and in setting policy. And the Federal Reserve, given this opportunity to do what it wanted, printed too much money and allowed too much credit to be created, and it completely, well, it exploded.
And I think for our listeners, they have to understand that the Federal Reserve is simply a central bank, and it's although nominally related to the government, it really is pretty much independent in many respects, or it should be independent. That was the whole idea, because you couldn't trust politicians to do what was right, and so you needed supposedly the central bank was going to keep us from getting into a situation where we'd have too much money and too much credit and too much, building up the economy, so it would collapse. And that was the last thing. That was why they got the Federal Reserve in initially, the central bank, was to prevent exactly what's going on today.
Yes, that is correct. It really was an outgrowth of the panic of 1907, when there was the government was helpless. At that point, to be able to stop the panic, and it did. It was really sort of lassoed by J.P. Morgan, and the government decided, well, from now on, we're going to have to be able to do more. So they created the Federal Reserve, and in time, what it has done is created this monster that is going to collapse.
But, of course, sitting in 1907, there was a difficult time, but it didn't threaten to collapse the economy. This really threatens to really collapse the economy and the currency, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, as much as yes. And finance was not that important 100 years ago. But over, really, during Greenspan's term, is when finance really took over the economy. He leveraged it and let it grow and grow until, at this point, finance is a very large part of the economy.
And, of course, if you destroy the value of a currency, you destroy the stability of a nation. We'll be right back. Well, you go right ahead with your thoughts, because I think it's so vitally important that people understand. Really, of course, the entire economy is based upon money, and the money, certainly the flow of money, the amount of money, the interest rates, all of these things are determined theoretically by the Federal Reserve System, which is supposedly made up of intelligent men who are going to keep us from getting into problems and give us a stable and prosperous society.
Yes, and as you had mentioned just a little bit earlier about the importance of a stable currency and what has happened. The 70s, I think, was a preview of the period that we're going into. The 1970s, and there might be some young listeners who don't remember them, was a period of very high price inflation. It grew throughout the decade. And this was, and I wrote about it in my book, was really dislocating to a lot of Americans. The people who did well were the people who were clever and were able to figure out how to move from one area of speculation to the next, and those who were generally older were those who were left behind. They were used to savings accounts. They didn't understand how all of these changes were happening in the financial system. And I say that was, I think, a preview of what we're entering right now. And I'm afraid that what we saw back then is going to be accentuated over the next few years with the few and the clever who will do very well, but most people will not be able to turn in a dime, as we're going to find from one minute to the next, in order to be able to just stay where they were before.
Well, I love that quotation you had from Rhett Butler from Gone with the Wind about the two times to make money. One is when the society is expanding, the economy is expanding, and you make it slowly, and the other is when it's collapsing. And then, of course, you can make it very, very quickly.
Yes. And that has happened in different societies. The classic in the West is Germany in 1923, when they had the hyperinflation. And there were some people who made fantastic fortunes, but most people, well, most families lost all of their money. And that is the sort of thing, you know, on a small scale that did happen during the 1970s, that there were some who got ahead. Real estate.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Frederick Sheehan is basically, he's been in the investment business in the past. He's been worked for companies like John Hancock Financial Services. He's co-authored other books dealing with Alan Greenspan and what's going on financially at the present time. And the present time, he's advisor to investment firms and endowments, so he understands the money game. But he also realized, of course, the key individual who we can attribute so much of what's going on to is a man named Alan Greenspan. And certainly I concur with that. I think that if you look at the Greenspans, what he did, he knew what needed to be done. He tells you in his book, Age of Turbulence, you know, the purpose of the head of the Federal Reserve System is to take away the punch bowl when the party gets interesting. Meaning, in other words, take away the source of all of the prosperity when the economy gets out of line. But instead of taking away the punch bowl, when things begin getting out of line, Alan Greenspan was pouring in rum and whiskey and all, everything imaginable, to stimulate the economy and by holding down interest rates, expanding the money supply, and he created the stock market bubble, and then he created the housing bubble. But anyway, you pick up the story there, because I think it's so vitally important that people understand that certainly we saw this in the 1970s. It culminated in about 1980 when Paul Volcker came in and did what was right, just strangled the economy financially, raised the interest rates higher than the rate of inflation. We were running, 17 or 18% inflation at that time?
Yes. Long-term treasury rates went above 15%. And, short-term rates were, they were up to 22%. It was Volcker who brought it under control at that point. And Greenspan was there. Greenspan was quoted at one point, because housing speculation was a great way to make money in the 1970s, particularly in California. I think it was 1976, the average house price went up 28% in California. And Greenspan even spoke about how he thought, this is I think in 1980, that a reason that the economy had done as well as it had was because of the people who had cashed out equity out of the houses. He was just rerunning the old play. In the 2003, 2004, he had seen it and talked about it back in the 1970s.
But instead of doing what was right and what I'm sure he knew should be done, he did just the opposite. And the question is, why?
I think at that point, it's difficult to say. I don't want to say that I know what is running around his mind. He had... when he came into the Federal Reserve chairmanship in 1987, he had consistently, whenever there was a problem, loosened money, and he hadn't tightened it. And particularly, the big change, I think, in the U.S. economy was after the recession in 1990, and it was at that point Greenspan lowered interest rates down to 3%. That might sound high now, but that was very low back then, from over 9%. And really, what got the economy running again was leveraging of hedge funds, of investment banks. This might sound like it's something that's just recent, but that was really what got the economy back going back then. And was how... money was moving. It was moving away from industry, and it was moving into the hands of banks and highly leveraged investors. And then every time the economy, or he thought the economy, was in trouble after that, he cut rates, he increased the money supply, he reduced reserve requirements on banks so that they could lend more. And by the time that he let the housing bubble just run amok, he either was going to do that, or he was going to do what he should have done to begin with, which was to rein in the economy. And I think he was just scared to death at that point to do the right thing. And
but, of course, that's what he is supposed to do. He is the man who's supposed to prevent the congressman from destroying our economy by excessive spending. I certainly what George Bush did was to he cut taxes and then he increased spending. Well, there's nothing wrong with cutting taxes, but you can't cut taxes and increase spending. And Alan Greenspan knew that. And yet, of course, he did not come forward, and he may have made some occasional remark that maybe that's not such a good idea, but he didn't really come out and really oppose this and go to the media and just to go before Congress and said, this is going to lead to disaster. And certainly, he certainly did nothing to rein in the predatory lending practices that led to the housing bust. He certainly encouraged the use of derivatives, which is, of course, that's the next bubble that's going. And when that one goes, I don't know what's going to happen. But he seemed that here was the time of crisis when he really should have knew what he should do. He should take away the punch bowl. And he didn't do it. And it's really, if there's anybody responsible, wouldn't you say Alan Greenspan is the man who bears the maximum responsibility for the destruction of our economic system?
Yes. Certainly his successor has done a miserable job, but he was handed a real can of worms when he came into office. Greenspan stepped down on January 31st, 2006. So Bernanke came in 2006, and he's been chairman since then. And he has done everything that Greenspan did, and even on a grander scale. But it was Greenspan who left the economy, by the time Bernanke, it wasn't much of an economy anymore. It had become a financial, a leverage game that is practically most of the economy now.
But so many people have been hurt. I mean, so many people have lost their homes. So many people have lost their jobs. Many people have lost the value of their savings. And my fear is that as the economy gets worse and we begin to destroy the value of our currency, this is going to wipe out the life savings of countless millions of Americans as you debauch the currency. And yet, in his book, The Age of Turbulence, Greenspan talks about the danger of debauching the currency, and yet that's exactly what he did by increasing the money supply and lowering the interest rates.
Yes. And he knew, he understood what was happening. One thing with Alan Greenspan is that at some time or another he expressed just about any opinion on every topic, but he did talk enough about the currency to understand that what he was doing was destroying the currency.
Well, of course, we're really at a more or less of a crisis situation today, and you as a financial advisor, what do you tell people at this turn, at this time in history?
Well, this is unlike any time before. For one thing, it's never been before that the whole world is running on a fiat currency. Generally, there has been some standard, at least in a good part of the world, such as the gold standard. And maybe I should just explain that for a second. That the classic gold standard, which wasn't the one after World War II, but it was one in which the gold, 1 ounce of gold was worth $20.67, and in which somebody could decide that they thought that the government, they didn't trust the dollar, and they could go into the bank, or I think a bank back then, and turn in $20.67 and receive 1 ounce of gold. And that kept the government honest when it came to printing money. Now, in 1971, we left the gold standard. It was a less rigid gold standard, but nevertheless, it was a gold standard. And from that point forward is when the United States and the West really increased the debt and also the social spending that governments were able to engage in that they had never been able to engage in before, and which is a reason why countries like Greece and Spain are in such trouble right now.
Well, I think it's really a tragic situation. I don't think the average person really understands the economic system, and most people are just sort of trapped in this unfortunate situation today, as we're seeing the very foundation, the economic foundation of our nation being destroyed. Well, you make a number of points, certainly, about Alan Greenspan's background. You point out, for instance, that really how stable the world was, the economy of the world was, prior to the advent of the Federal Reserve System, that basically, you know, that the prices were stable. They had been for many years, and 100 years or so. And then, but since 1914, what cost a dollar then now will cost $20 today. And that's really, I think a lot of things will cost even more than that. But certainly the massive devaluation of the value of our currency, and yet the Federal Reserve System was supposedly established to prevent that, to give stability to the economic system. What went wrong?
Well, from the beginning, it was an organization without a mandate. The original legislation left a lot to be desired as to what exactly the Federal Reserve was or what it should do.
Hold on, Doc. We'll be back in just a moment here. Go right ahead.
And from the beginning, it really entered into different expansionary...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iOtterol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey Water Filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Reserve system, you keep a certain amount in reserves, and then you could lend out 8 or 9 or 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 times the amount you have on reserves, and they could determine how much money there'd be in the credit that'd be out there by regulating the reserves. But they allowed the banks to lend exorbitant sums of money, some of them lending 30 or 40 times what they have in reserve. That's what happened to Bear Stearns. I think they were lending something like 41-42%, 40 times, I should say, the amount of money that they actually had in reserve.
That's what officially is said. The investment banks were leveraging much higher than that. I don't know if that's gotten much notice in the press. What they would do is that during a quarter, they would leverage sometimes 60 to 1. I heard as much as 80 to 1. Their traders actually got paid. Their bonuses were dependent on reducing that amount of leverage by the end of the quarter when they had to report make public filings of how leveraged they were. And, of course, the regulator should have seen this, but they didn't. They were walking time bombs, and they probably still are. It was that amount of credit that is allowed on each dollar of money that the banks hold that kept expanding and kept going into different areas, whether it was personal credit or maybe for commercial property, or we can see lots of carcasses around the country now of what was lent and has fallen into disrepair and left people in ruin.
And, of course, this is really going to result really in a tremendous catastrophe down the line as this whole system, overinflated system, begins to contract, and all this money simply, well, it's not really money, it's simply the figment of imagination. Mm-hmm. It all begins to dissolve, and when it's not there, how is this society going to function?
I'd start with what you said just a second ago, which is that we have to contract, we have to deleverage, which means that we're going to have to recognize the losses, which means that it will force, bad businesses out of business, but it will also take a lot of good businesses out too, simply because of how leveraged we have become. Not looking at money right now so much as the economy as a whole. You take it for instance, the problems that we have with municipalities now. Well, a lot of that was because municipalities saw that this endless amount of tax revenue that was increasing. They gave out too much in benefits, so they billed too much. And now this is a tremendous overhang on the economy. And all those people who had those jobs, or have those jobs, whether it was working for the towns or maybe in construction, building new schools, building new football fields or whatever it might be, all of that has to be deleveraged. It has to be reduced to a sustainable size. And so that is going to go on for quite a while with consequences of people either losing their jobs or having jobs at lower salaries and having to really cut back on the way that we live.
Well, of course, a lot of communities have certainly been living quite well. They didn't really have to be too worried about expenditures. Well, they just go out and borrow money. And so you have the municipal bonds and your sewer bonds and your library bonds. And a lot of people would buy those bonds. They were tax exempt. And that was a real good deal for the people who bought the bonds. It was a good deal for the communities as long as they could service the bonds. But what happens when the communities can't service their bonds? Then what happens?
Well, I think that right now they are getting, the federal government is helping in a lot of ways in preventing default. I mean, that's what eventually happened, will be default. And there will come the point, it may be coming pretty soon, when the federal government is not going to be able to come in and prop up, say, the state of Illinois, as it has been doing. And with some of the states, there are cities now that are close to default, and those bondholders are going to be very surprised because what they've been told, what is standard in the catalog.
Hold that tech, we'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess, of course, is Frederick Sheehan. We're talking about his book, Panderer to Power. It's the background of Alan Greenspan, who laid the foundation for what is taking place today. And you were just saying that a lot of the bondholders, people holding municipal bonds and other types of bonds, are in for a surprise.
Yes. They are going to be in for a surprise. It's a very under studied area, even by the people who sell the bonds, and the financial advisors have traditionally, and even more so over the past few years when earning interest has been so difficult, and steered clients towards municipal bonds as the safe choice. And I know from talking to people every day, the people are surprised when I say there's going to be a municipal bond collapse, and they just had no idea. They have no idea, but it is coming, and it is going to really affect, in particularly municipal bondholders being older people who need the income, will not only suffer the loss of income, but also the loss of principal on some of these bonds when they go into default. The other problem is that it's a market that will get dragged down. The good will go down with the bad, so that even, and there will be plenty of good bonds, but what will happen is that when there is the shock of municipal defaults, that the market itself will sell off, for those good bonds, those who hold them, they'll still receive the coupon, but I'm afraid that for a lot of people, they're going to be shocked to see that all of a sudden their municipal bond price just dropped 30% or 40%. Now, it may come back, but it is going to be a very disorienting experience for people who hold municipal bonds. People who hold municipal bonds aren't investing for adventure, the way that at least people who own stock should be prepared for some adventures. And I think it is going to be, unless it's somebody who really understands municipal bonds, my advice would be to really look carefully at what you hold, and it may be the better time right now to accept the fact that you might have to dig into principal rather than get a 3 or 4% coupon in order to meet expenses.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Frederick Sheehan. His book is Panderer to Power. Frederick, do you have a website, and how can people get your book?
Yes. I do have a website, and it is aucontrarian.com, AU as in gold, and then contrarian as in the word contrarian.com. And there I have articles. I have I write a blog. There are also some interviews and a speech. And as far as getting my book, they could get it off my website. They could go to a bookstore. They could go to Amazon, where the book is available.
All right, fine. Well, of course, it's really, it gives sort of a history of Alan Greenspan. I mean, where he was born, where he was raised. I mean, his history, most people don't know. Was he a saxophone player or clarinet?
Yeah, he grew up in New York City, Washington Heights, and he was born in 1926. So he was the Depression boy. He knew what it was like, the rough times. Then he went on to, he was a very good clarinetist and saxophonist. He went to the Juilliard School, which only accepts the best students. But then from there, he knew that he wasn't ever going to be a great musician. He went on to get a degree at NYU. Then he went to Columbia University, studied under Arthur Burns. And Arthur Burns eventually became Federal Reserve Chairman in the 1970s. He was the Federal Reserve Chairman who administered the 10% double-digit inflation in the 1970s. Greenspan always stayed close to him, and Greenspan became the Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, which is the really an advisor to the President on economic matters under President Ford. So he was there while Burns was at the Federal Reserve. Greenspan received accolades from those around Ford as to the advice he gave Ford. What exactly it was that so impressed Ford, it's difficult to tell, since when Greenspan went for to be his nomination hearing in 1987 for the Federal Reserve Board, it was Senator Proxmire who had done the research and looked at Greenspan's predictions when it came to interest rates and GDP growth, inflation, so forth. And as Proxmire said, you were off. You were way off. You were up much more than any other Council of Economic Advisor over a 12-year period. And Greenspan, being Greenspan, said, "I think you're wrong about that." And Proxmire said, "I have them here." And Greenspan said, "Can I see them?" And, "Oh, I guess you're right. I guess I was wrong." But I think this was the important thing in the hearing. Proxmire did not want Greenspan to be Federal Reserve Chairman. He didn't care so much, I think, about the predictions, as it was that Proxmire understood where banking was going. And I have some of what Proxmire said in that hearing in my book. I wish I could have put more in, simply because it was he was able to see ahead to exactly what happened. Proxmire said that you are devoted to big banking. Greenspan was on the board of directors of J.P. Morgan and Morgan Guarantee, and he also was lobbying for Sears to be able to go into banking. Proxmire said that this is a disastrous thing. We're going through a great change in banking in which we're having consolidation. It is destroying competition among banks. And we're going to have a consolidation of banking that is not in the best interest of this country and is going to squeeze the smaller banks out of existence. And Greenspan offered no rebuttal. You know, usually we got used to him as Federal Reserve Chairman coming up with some sort of excuse or counter-argument, but apparently, looking at the transcript, he just sat there while Proxmire went on. And at the end of it, Proxmire really seemed to just throw in the towel, not only with Greenspan, but with other senators. He said that your nomination should result in a knockdown, drag-out fight on the Senate floor of, really, whether we want to have a Federal Reserve chairman who is going to create these monster banks, or whether we don't want that in our future. And and we wound up with Greenspan as Federal Reserve Chairman. And within a year, he allowed J.P. Morgan to underwrite a Xerox debt issue, which was the first time since the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, which had separated commercial banking from investment banking, the separation because of these conflicts that had been seen after the stock market crash in 1929. And Alan Greenspan, as Federal Reserve Chairman, was able to waive the Glass-Steagall Act and allow J.P. Morgan to underwrite Xerox debt. And then the following year, he allowed J.P. Morgan to underwrite a stock issue, which Time Magazine said this is the greatest rupture of Glass-Steagall yet. By the time in 1999, and a lot has been made recently because of Glass-Steagall having been overturned in 1999, but by that point, Greenspan and the Federal Reserve, which has such great authority when it comes to banking, have a lot to already dismantle the Glass-Steagall Act. Banks were already doing many things that by the 1999 legislation was simply overturning what had been permitted by the Federal Reserve over the past decade of Greenspan's chairmanship.
And I think it's vitally important for people to recognize that here's Alan Greenspan coming as from a member of the board of the J.P. Morgan Chase. And then, of course, he gets to be the chairman of the Federal Reserve System. What does he do? He gives all sorts of special favors to J.P. Morgan Chase. But the difficulty is the ordinary banks are banks, and they should be doing banking, not investing and putting out investing and doing things that the hedge funds do and all these sort of fancy creative sorts of financial affairs, because, of course, basically they can accumulate great wealth. But, well, we see Goldman Sachs, for instance, on one hand selling all of its customers these collateralized debt obligation bonds, telling them how great they are, and then turning around and taking out derivative contracts, suggesting they're going to plummet, which they did. And, of course, Goldman Sachs made a lot of money. And their customers who believe Goldman Sachs, I mean, many of them just did phenomenal losses. And yet, of course, this is what happened, and especially with the derivative now, where these banks could begin, instead of doing banking, they're making all sorts of, you know, fabulous bets and wagers, because this is really what it's all about, and writing insurance policies, which banks are not supposed to do, but writing insurance policies without any money behind them. That's what a derivative is an insurance policy without any money behind it. It's incredible.
Yes, that's a point that I forget to make, is that there are no reserves, there is no capital required behind derivatives contracts. You know, when a bank lends, it has to have capital. That is, that it has to have money on hand that loans go bad. It has a certain amount of loan reserves, has a certain amount of capital that is standing there, which gives you an assurance, it used to give us assurance, that a bank was capitalized enough that it could withstand losses. But with derivatives, there are no reserve requirements. There's no capital required. And this is a market of $600 trillion that is over 10 times the size of the world economy. It's so much. much larger than the banking system, the financial system, the economy, that losses just will not be able to be absorbed.
And, of course, the tragedy is that we've done exactly what they did prior to the Great Depression. That's the Glass-Steagall Act, so that we would never get into that situation again. And of course, it was done away with in 1999. And Greenspan said he did not object to it. That's the incredible thing. And that led us up to the point where we are today. Certainly now, we've lost a lot of our major banks. We're down to about 6 major banks and about 8,000 or so, 8,300. Smaller banks, but we're losing an awful lot of those. We lose a couple, 3, 4, 5 every single week. I think we've already lost, 83, 85 so far this year, and we'll probably lose a similar number the next 6 months, or maybe even more. A couple of 100 banks will go down this year, and who knows how many will go down in the coming years. And it looks like we're just centralizing all power with these major banks.
Yes, and this latest banking legislation, it looks like it might not have the votes now. Who knows? But in any case, what form it actually is passed in will probably be pretty close to what we saw that was passed on by the House on Friday, and it is really among other things, it's going to kill small banking. The amount of regulation that is going to be required, it can't be absorbed by small banks. This happened back in the 2003, when we had the legislation that came out of what the brokerages did during the dot-com bubble and the telecom bubble. And then lots of new legislation came in, which required all kinds of new paperwork. Something like Merrill Lynch can easily absorb something like that. Well, I knew people who had small brokerage operations. They might have had maybe 5 brokers, maybe 10 brokers. They could not compete. They couldn't make money anymore because of the amount of paperwork they had to do. And for instance, one firm did a lot of advisory work in addition to being a broker. Well, they all had to give up their brokerage licenses. And if a firm was larger, then maybe somebody like Merrill would have bought it and just absorbed it. So this eliminated a lot of smaller competition. Not only is it bad because the large banks not having competition, but it also gives less diversity, if that's the word, for people who are looking for advice. They don't have the smaller brokerages with maybe some different points of view than they get out of a large brokerage firm. And I'm afraid that's what's going to happen with the banking now, that with the amount of requirements, it's going to force smaller banks either to merge, probably to merge, with other banks, and it won't be good. I'm a big proponent of small banking rather than large banks, and of having somebody who knows you rather than a large bank where you're some computer number. From that standpoint, and from actually every other standpoint, I think this banking legislation is not good.
Well, I certainly tend to agree with you. My problem is that it seems that the power is in the hands of these banks, and they really give so much money to the politicians. We know that the Goldman Sachs is gave almost $1 million to Barack Obama. We know that, of course, George Soros, I don't know how much he gave to all sorts of other committees and organizations, but we're talking about tens of millions of dollars. We've got some of the finest politicians money could buy, and they're not interested in what's best for the people or for the country, but simply, they're getting paid for services rendered. One of the things you mentioned in your book was the fact that shortly after Alan Greenspan left as chairman of the Federal Reserve System, he was asked to give a speech for Lehman Brothers for $250 $250,000. $250,000. That must have been a pretty good speech, wasn't it? Or do you think that was payment for services rendered?
Payment for services rendered.
$250,000 for one speech. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, talk about, you know, well, we would not say, you know, they were paying him off, but they were paying him off.
Yeah. Of course, he also has had his other relationships since then. He has a consulting relationship with Deutsche Bank, with John Paulson, the hedge fund manager, who did very well. I'm not knocking John Paulson at all for having made so much money for having bet against the mortgage crash. He was just doing what anybody with good sense could see was coming.
Well, but of course, basically Alan Greenspan said nobody could have seen this coming. Nobody could have seen it coming. So as soon as he gets out, he goes to work for John Paulson and PIMCO, the two large hedge funds. We don't know how much he's getting, but you'd be sure he's getting tens of millions of dollars. They vote against the housing market, which Alan Greenspan says nobody could possibly know was coming. I think it was John Paulson made something like $13 billion, you know, when that thing crashed. And I don't know how much the PIMCO made, but, I mean, they took his advice. He knew it was going to happen. But, of course, he now says, oh, well, nobody could have known. But, well, the people he told what was going to happen have done very, very well.
And I think that there were, he says that now, but there were a lot of people who could see it coming. A lot of people who didn't have the resources of John Paulson to be able to make large bets against it and to be able to make money out of it. But there were certainly a lot of people who knew that the housing market had gone. It was like something they had never seen in their lifetime. And from that perspective, they knew that this was going to come to no good end.
Sort of like the Tulip Mania and the South Sea Island investments, and I think it was Florida Land, something on the Florida swaps. People were buying lots there, and they kept going up and up. But, I mean, you knew the housing bubble couldn't keep going, and Alan Greenspan knew it couldn't keep going, and yet he was doing everything to encourage it. And actually, we have examples of his testimony saying, oh, you know, get these alternative rate loans and get these all these short-term loans, and you know, we'll get a rollover and be reassessed. I mean, he was doing everything to encourage people to buy homes who couldn't afford homes.
Yes, he gave that speech on advising Americans to take out adjustable rate mortgages rather than fixed rate mortgages on February 23rd, 2004. This was at a point when just within the couple of days before
Hold that thought.
Sure.
Please go right ahead.
Sure. Just within a couple of days before he gave that advice, it had been announced that house prices had risen over 20% in the last year in California.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
Well, I was horrified when I saw the plight of the people in Haiti after the earthquake, but a similar event could happen right here in the United States, and that's why you should call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD, that's 866-404-FOOD, and purchase a supply of his products.
Freeze drying is a great way to preserve food. I know because I bought a supply 40 years ago, and when I opened a can recently, the food was as fresh and tasty as when I purchased it. We're living in uncertain times, so if you'd like to have a supply of ground beef, diced beef, chicken, vegetables, or fruit on hand, call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-FOOD, and mention you heard about him right here at Radio Liberty.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com.
Getting out of money, get into things that are tangible. And now, suddenly, I've only talked to Frederick one other time, but so much of what he says is just what we say over and over again in our program. In fact, his website starts with AU, meaning gold. And suddenly, you can look him up on the internet. Go to his blog site. That's Frederick Sheehan, and fascinating information. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the time when I certainly need to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported, and things are a little tight recently. If you're in a position to help, we'd love to hear from you. We want to maintain our 60 outlets because people are beginning to learn, and they're beginning to understand what is really going on in the world today. And if you can give us a hand, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. We have a book written by Thomas Wood called Meltdown. It's an excellent coverage of what's going on today from the conservative point of view and how we got into the problem. We have my little pamphlets. There's one of them called The History of Money. One is Prophetic Warning, and it's simply my five newsletters on Andrew Jackson's farewell speech in 1837, where he talks about how the banks are going to take over control of the government if you don't watch out. And finally, my financial meltdown. It's at the five newsletters we wrote about the financial crisis and my impression of why Alan Greenspan did what he did. And Sidney, I don't know whether I'm right, but I will tell you it's an interesting thing to conjecture that he did what he did intentionally and purposely to bring down our economy. Now, whether he did that so that we'll go into a chaotic situation and accept the New World Order, which Alan Greenspan talks about in his January 2009 article in New York Times titled, A Chance for a New World Order. Henry Kissinger, New York Times, January 2009, A Chance for a New World Order, whether that's what it's about, or maybe this is the only hope we have to be able to oppose the New World Order is that people will suddenly begin to realize the evil people who created all of this, and they're doing it because they have an intense hatred of America. Their loyalty is to this internationalist dream, and behind that, the powerful spiritual forces that energize them. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, shame on you. If you can't afford it, go up to our website, RadioLiberty.com. It's the first video on the section that talks about videos, so you can go there and get the information. You can, of course, listen to our programs 9 hours a day on the Internet and try to get other people to listen, to understand that they're trying intentionally to destroy our economy and impoverish our people.
that they intend to take us into a world government, and they're going to take us into a war with Iran, and out of the chaos that's coming from that will come the destruction of the finances of this nation. There will be chaos in our streets. There will be certainly acts of violence here, whether real or simply false flag operations. Remember, of course, that the number two man in the Irish Republican Army that was bombing London and killing all those Britishers, the number two man in the Irish Republican Army was a member of British intelligence. And as we see so many, of course, what's going on today, so many of the acts of violence and really have been carried out by government agents. Certainly, there was a fellow named Hal Turner. He was on a talk show host making all sorts of ridiculous claims. And why was he doing this and totally discrediting everybody in the conservative movement? Because he was an FBI plant. This came out on his trial. And he said, I was employed by the FBI to do all of these things. Ladies and gentlemen, we're in real trouble. Until you understand what's going on, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. You need to listen to my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get our talk on the Financial Armageddon, Financial Tsunami, and then please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Terry Cook. And Terry was with the police force. He was a detective, if I recall, for a long period of time, and he retired, and he did some wonderful work on the National Security Council, and I should say the National NSA, National Security Administration, and it's the super secret spy operation, much larger and much more powerful than the CIA. You hear about the CIA, but the NSA is listening to all of your telephone calls, reading all of your emails, certainly reading all of your faxes. They do this with computers. They do it all throughout the world. A much larger staff than the CIA, and most people really don't even know about NSA, Big Brother watching you, and we'll probably carry that book. Is that back in print yet, Terry?
Yes. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and Stan, it's an honor to be back on the show. And yes, I first wrote about that NSA situation in the late 90s after I had first written a book called The Mark of the New World Order, Stan, as you well know. Describing microchip implants, and I asked myself, gee, self, who's going to be tracking all this? What organization might be responsible for tracking microchip implants and ID cards and all that stuff I discussed in my first book, which was 750 pages, telephone directory, as it were. And so the next logical conclusion, Stan, the only computerized system on Earth that was large